Chapter 18. In which Morgana advances towards fame and honor, and in which several great literary characters make their appearance. We must begin, my dear madam, said Sir George Thrum, by unlearning all that Mr. Bereskye, of whom I do not wish to speak with the slightest disrespect, has taught you. Morgana knew that every professor says as much, and submitted to undergo the study requisite for Sir George's system with perfect good grace. O fond, as I was given to understand, the methods of the two artists were pretty similar, but as there was rivalry between them, and continual desertion of scholars from one school to another, it was fair for each to take all the credit he could get in the success of any pupil. If a pupil failed, for instance, Thrum would say Bereskye had spoiled her irretrievably, while the German would regret that young woman, who had a good organ, should have thrown away her dime with that old drum. When one of these deserters succeeded, yes, yes, would either professor cry, I formed her, she owes her fortune to me. Both of them thus, in future days, claimed the education of the famous Ravenswing. And even Sir George Thrum, though he wished to ecrisser the ligonier, pretended that her present success was his work, because once as he had been brought by her mother, Mrs. Larkins, to sing for Sir George's approval. When the two professors met, it was with the most delighted cordiality on the part of both. Ein lieber Herr, Thrum would say with some malice, your sonata in X flat is divine. Hevelier, Bereskye would reply, that and Dante movement in W is worthy of Beethoven. I give you my sacred honor, and so forth. In fact, they loved each other as gentlemen in their profession always do. The two famous professors conduct their academies on very opposite principles. Bereskye writes ballet music. Thrum, on the contrary, says he cannot but deplore the dangerous fascinations of the dance, and writes more for Exeter Hall and Birmingham. While Bereskye drives a cab in the park with a very suspicious Mademoiselle Leocady, Ramonade, by his side, you may see Thrum walking to evening church with his lady, and hymns are sung there of his own composition. He belongs to the Athenaeum Club, he goes to the levee once a year, he does everything that a respectable man should, and if, by the means of this respectability, he manages to make his little trade far more profitable than it otherwise would be, are we to quarrel with him for it? Sir George, in fact, had every reason to be respectable. He had been a choir boy at Windsor, had played to the old king's violoncello, had been intimate with him, and had received knighthood at the hand of his revered sovereign. He had a snuff box which his majesty gave him, and portraits of him, and the young princes all over the house. He had also a foreign order, no other, indeed, than the Elephant and Castle of Kalbsbrit and Pumpernickel, conferred upon him by the Grand Duke, when here with the allied sovereigns in 1814. With this ribbon round his neck, on gala days, and in a white waistcoat, the old gentleman looked splendid as he moved along in a blue coat with the Windsor button, and neat black small clothes, and silk stockings. He lived in an old, tall, dingy house, furnished in the reign of George III. His beloved master, and not much more cheerful now than a family vault. They are awfully funereal, those ornaments of the close of the last century, tall gloomy horsehair chairs, moldy turkey carpets with wretched druggets to guard them, little cracked sticking plaster miniatures of people in tours and pigtails over high-shouldered mantelpieces. Two dismal urns on each side of a lanky sideboard, and in the midst a queer twisted receptacle for worn-out knives with green handles. Under the sideboard, stands a cellaret that looks as if it held half a bottle of currant wine, and a shivering plate warmer that never could get any comfort out of the wretched old cramped grate yonder. Don't you know in such houses the gray gloom that hangs over the stairs, the dull-colored old carpet that winds its way up the same, growing thinner, duller, and more threadbare as it mounts to the bedroom floors? There is something awful in the bedroom of a respectable old couple of 65. Think of the old feathers, turbans, bugles, petticoats, pomatum pots, Spencers, white satin shoes, false fronts, the old flaccid boneless stays tied up in faded ribboned, the dusky fans, the old 40-year-old baby linen, the letters of Sir George when he was young, the doll of poor Maria who died in 1803, Frederick's first corduroy breeches, and the newspaper which contains the account of his distinguishing himself at the siege of Seringapatam. All these lie somewhere, damp and squeezed down into glum old presses and wardrobes. At that glass the wife has sat many times these 50 years. In that old Morocco better children were born. Where are they now? Fred the brave captain, and Charles the saucy colleger. There hangs a drawing of him done by Mr. Beachy, and that sketch by Cosway was the very likeness of Louis before Mr. Fitzpoodle. For heaven's sake, come down. What are you doing in a lady's bedroom? The fact is, madam, I had no business there in life. But, having had quite enough wine with Sir George, my thoughts had wandered upstairs into the sanctuary of female excellence, where your ladyship nightly reposes. You do not sleep so well now as in old days, though there is no patter of little steps to wake you overhead. They call that room the nursery still, and the little wicket still hangs at the upper stairs. It has been there for 40 years, bon Dieu. Can't you see the ghosts of little faces peering over it? I wonder whether they get up in the night as the moonlight shines into the blank vacant old room, and play there solemnly with little ghostly horses, and the spirits of dolls, and tops that turn and turn but don't hum. Once more, sir. Come down to the lower story, that is to the Morgina story with which the above sentences have no more to do than this morning's leading article in the Times. Only it was at this house of Sir George Thrums that I met Morgina. Sir George, in old days, had instructed some of the female members of our family, and I recollect cutting my fingers as a child with one of those attenuated green-handled knives in the queer box yonder. In those days Sir George Thrum was the first great musical teacher of London, and the royal patronage brought him a great number of fashionable pupils, of whom Lady Fitzpoodle was one. It was a long, long time ago. In fact, Sir George Thrum was old enough to remember persons who had been present at Mr. Braham's first appearance, and the old gentleman's days of triumph had been those of Billington and Incledon, Catalani and Madame Storrs. He was the author of several operas, The Camel Driver, Britain's Alarmed, or The Siege of Bergen op Zoom, etc., etc., and, of course, of songs which had considerable success in their day, but are forgotten now, and are as much faded and out of fashion as those old carpets which we have described in the professor's house, and which were, doubtless, very brilliant ones. But such is the fate of carpets, of flowers, of music, of men, and of the most admirable novels. Even this story will not be alive for many centuries. Well, well, why struggle against fate? But, though his heyday of fashion was gone, Sir George still held his place among the musicians of the old school, conducted occasionally at the ancient concerts and the Philharmonic, and his glees are still favorites after public dinners, and are sung by those old bacchanalians, in chestnut wigs, who attend for the purpose of amusing the guests on such occasions of festivity. The great old people at the gloomy old concerts before mentioned always pay Sir George marked respect, and, indeed, from the old gentleman's peculiar behavior to his superiors, it is impossible they should not be delighted with him, so he leads at almost every one of the concerts in the old-fashioned houses in town. Becomingly obsequious to his superiors, he is with the rest of the world properly majestic, and has obtained no small success by his admirable and undeviating respectability. Respectability has been his great card through life. Ladies can trust their daughters at Sir George Thrum's academy. Good musician, madam, says he to the mother of a new pupil, should not only have a fine ear, a good voice, and an indomitable industry, but, above all, a faultless character, faultless, that is, as far as our poor nature will permit. And you will remark that those young persons with whom your lovely daughter, Miss Smith, will pursue her musical studies, are all, in a moral point of view, as spotless as that charming young lady. How should it be otherwise? I have been myself the father of a family. I have been honored with the intimacy of the wisest and best of kings, my late sovereign George III. And I can proudly show an example of decorum to my pupils in my Sophia. Mrs. Smith, I have the honor of introducing to you my Lady Thrum. The old lady would rise at this, and make a gigantic curtsy, such a one as had begun the minuet at Ranelagh 50 years ago, and, the introduction ended, Mrs. Smith would retire, after having seen the portraits of the princes, his late majesty's snuff box, and a piece of music which he used to play, noted by himself. Mrs. Smith, I say, would drive back to Baker Street, delighted to think that her Frederica had secured so eligible and respectable a master. I forgot to say that, during the interview between Mrs. Smith and Sir George, the latter would be called out of his study by his black servant, and my Lady Thrum would take that opportunity of mentioning when he was knighted, and how he got his foreign order, and deploring the sad condition of other musical professors, and the dreadful immorality which sometimes arose in consequence of their laxness. Sir George was a good deal engaged to dinners in the season, and if invited to dine with a nobleman, as he might possibly be on the day when Mrs. Smith requested the honor of his company, he would write back that he should have had the sincerest happiness in waiting upon Mrs. Smith in Baker Street, if, previously, my Lord Tweedledale had not been so kind as to engage him. This letter, of course, shown by Mrs. Smith to her friends, was received by them with proper respect, and thus, in spite of age and new fashions, Sir George still reigned preeminent for a mile round Cavendish Square. By the young pupils of the academy he was called Sir Charles Grandison, and, indeed, fully deserved this title on account of the indomitable respectability of his whole actions. It was under this gentleman that Morgina made her debut in public life. I do not know what arrangements may have been made between Sir George Thrum and his pupil regarding the profits which were to accrue to the former from engagements procured by him for the latter, but there was, no doubt, an understanding between them. For Sir George, respectable as he was, had the reputation of being extremely clever at a bargain, and Lady Thrum herself, in her great high tragedy way, could purchase a pair of soles, or select a leg of mutton with the best housekeeper in London. When, however, Morgina had been for some 6 months under his tuition, he began, for some reason or other, to be exceedingly hospitable, and invited his friends to numerous entertainments. At one of which, as I have said, I had the pleasure of meeting Mrs. Walker. Although the worthy musician's dinners were not good, the old knight had some excellent wine in his cellar, and his arrangement of his party deserves to be commended. For instance, he meets me and Bob Fitzurse in Pall Mall, at whose paternal house he was also a visitor. "Why, dear young gentleman," says he, "will you come and dine with a poor musical composer? I have some comet hock, and, what is more curious to you, perhaps, as men of wit, one or two of the great literary characters of London whom you would like to see quite curiosities, my dear young friends." And we agreed to go. To the literary men he says, "Have a little quiet party at home. Lord Roundtowers, the Honorable Mr. Fitzurse of the Life Guards, and a few more. Can you tear yourself away from the war of wits, and take a quiet dinner with a few mere men about town?" The literary men instantly purchase new satin stocks and white gloves, and are delighted to fancy themselves members of the world of fashion. Instead of inviting 12 royal academicians, or a dozen authors, or a dozen men of science to dinner, as His Grace the Duke of, and the Right Honorable Sir Robert are in the habit of doing once a year, this plan of fusion is the one they should adopt. Not invite all artists, as they would invite all farmers to a rent dinner, but they should have a proper commingling of artists and men of the world. There is one of the latter whose name is George Savage Fitzboodle, who but let us return to Sir George Thrum. officers and I arrive at the dismal old house, and are conducted up the staircase by a black servant, who shouts out, "Miss Office Boodle, the Honorable Miss Officers." It was evident that Lady Thrum had instructed the swarthy groom of the chambers, for there is nothing particularly honorable in my friend Fitz's face, that I know of, unless an abominable squint may be said to be so. Lady Thrum, whose figure is something like that of the shot tower opposite Waterloo Bridge, makes a majestic inclination and a speech, to signify her pleasure at receiving under her roof two of the children of Sir George's best pupils. A lady in black velvet is seated by the old fireplace, with whom a stout gentleman in an exceedingly light coat and ornamental waistcoat is talking very busily. "He great star of the night," whispers our host. "Mrs. Walker, gentleman the Ravenswing. She is talking to the famous Mr. Slang, of the theater." "Is she a fine singer?" says Fitzurse. "He's a very fine woman. My dear young friends, you shall hear tonight. I, who have heard every fine voice in Europe, confidently pledge my respectability that the Ravenswing is equal to them all. As he has the graces, sir, of a Venus with the mind of a muse. She is a siren, sir, without the dangerous qualities of one. She is hallowed, sir, by her misfortunes, as by her genius, and I am proud to think that my instructions have been the means of developing the wondrous qualities that were latent within her until now." "You don't say so," says Gobimich Fitzurse. Having thus indoctrinated Mr. Fitzurse, Sir George takes another of his guests, and proceeds to work upon him. "Why, dear Mr. Bluedier, how do you do?" "Mr. Fitzboodle, Mr. Bluedier, the brilliant and accomplished wit, whose sallies in the tomahawk delight us every Saturday. Nay, no blushes, my dear sir, you are very wicked, but oh, so pleasant. Well, Mr. Bluedier, I am glad to see you, sir, and hope you will have a favorable opinion of our genius, sir. As I was saying to Mr. Fitzboodle, as he has the graces of a Venus with the mind of a muse. She is a siren, without the dangerous qualities of one, etc." This little speech was made to half a dozen persons in the course of the evening, persons, for the most part, connected with the public journals or the theatrical world. There was Mr. Squinney, the editor of the Flowers of Fashion, Mr. Desmond Mulligan, the poet and reporter for a morning paper, and other worthies of their calling. For though Sir George is a respectable man, and as high-minded and moral an old gentleman as ever wore knee buckles, he does not neglect the little arts of popularity, and can condescend to receive very queer company if need be. For instance, at the dinner party at which I had the honor of assisting, and at which, on the right hand of Lady Thrum, sat the obliged nobleman, whom the Thrums were a great deal too wise to omit, the sight of a lord does good to us commoners, or why else should we be so anxious to have one? Dot in the second place of honor, and on her ladyship's left hand, sat Mr. Slang, the manager of one of the theaters, a gentleman whom my Lady Thrum would scarcely, but for a great necessity's sake, have been induced to invite to her table. He had the honor of leading Mrs. Walker to dinner, who looked splendid in black velvet and turban, full of health and smiles. Lord Roundtowers is an old gentleman who has been at the theaters 5 times a week for these 50 years, a living dictionary of the stage, recollecting every actor and actress who has appeared upon it for half a century. He perfectly well remembered Miss Delancey in Morgina. He knew what had become of Ali Baba, and how Kasim had left the stage, and was now the keeper of a public house. All this store of knowledge he kept quietly to himself, or only delivered in confidence to his next neighbor in the intervals of the banquet, which he enjoys prodigiously. He lives at an hotel. If not invited to dine, eats a mutton chop very humbly at his club, and finishes Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.